When the interim search committee, Dave Gologli, Christina Lentz, Michael Mason, and Nancy Dale, interviewed me just over 2 years ago, they asked me many good questions, but the one question they didn't ask was whether I was good at transitions. That would have been a showstopper, because the truth is, I'm not. I know, now I tell you. But I understand the dynamics of transitions, I understand the processes involved in transitions, and I see no reason why congregations shouldn't have smooth and easy transitions. But personally, the fact is beginnings and endings have always been challenging for me. You have heard my retirement anxieties at some length, but really, I didn't do any better when I turned 50. Some people breeze right through that transition, but I wasn't one of them. That year, my husband and I separated. I had major surgery. We sold the family home we'd lived in for 25 years. Both girls by then were in college, and even though they had chosen schools in New England, to me, they might as well have been on the moon. And that March, the dog died. There was a minister's convocation in Hot Springs, Arkansas, the spring of that year, and who did I run into but a colleague who had been the DRE when I was the new minister in Melrose. We made dinner plans. Her first question was, "How's Paul?" I was sad, and I cried a little as I told her the story, but we got through that, and then she asked how the girls were. The girls who were now living on the moon. And I cried again. And then, clearly hoping to find a surefire safe subject, she then asked how the dog was. The writer Anne Lamont says that by the time you are 50, if you haven't already, you will have had your heart broken. And yet, she says, you will learn to dance the minuet of old friendships and dance to the absurdities of life. And there is another benefit Lamont claims we gain as we get older, and that is that sometimes we actually grow into becoming the people we long to be. Through time, experience, failures, and triumphs, if we're lucky, she says, we sometimes get to have the life we yearn for. Would I, she asks, give all that up for firm thighs and a better memory? You bet, she said. And that's why it's such a blessing that we're not left to our own devices. I love ministry, and I have loved the two interim ministries I've done, but I could never have been a career interim minister. Too many beginnings and too many endings. Like you, I love church. I especially love worship and music and the children and projects and conversations and coming together to do good works. I love to see how people are drawn to different aspects of church life, some to budget preparation and finances, and some to teaching, and some to maintaining the property, and some to offering courses, and of course offering hosting coffee hour and doing social justice. The poet James Freeman wrote, "We need small harbors in our soul, where we can slip out of the sea to wait a moment and be whole. A book, a poem, a song may be enough. Some exercise, a walk, a time of solitary labor, a dog, a garden, talk shared with a passing friend. Sometimes the merest human touch. A silent prayer is such a place. Small harbors may be nothing much, but ah, they have a saving grace." I think What draws many of us here to church is that it provides a safe harbor for our souls, and not such a small one either. But if that was all church did, all church provided, a harbor, it would not have real meaning. In addition to being a harbor, church is also a place that stretches our minds, our hearts, and our spirits.
A reading by Leo Rosten. There is a creed to which, in my judgment, all free men and women must forever hold fast. We must learn that those we like are not always right, and those we don't like are not always wrong. We must learn to seek change without violence, not even in words, much less in deeds. We must be strong enough to be gentle. We must know that life will always have unbearable stretches of loneliness, and that we can never truly be understood, not even by those who love us, that we cannot completely understand someone else, no matter how much we want it. We must have the courage to live without absolutes, without dogmas, the courage to seek imaginative escapes from the straitjackets of conformity. We must learn to meet life with a series of tentative and impermanent approximations, knowing that the final goals may never be reached, that the last truths may be forever unknowable, but that life holds nothing more precious than the process by which, to the fullest stretches of which humans are capable, we stretch the mind and heart.
Isn't church at its best both of those things? Whether we admit it or not, or say it out loud or not, surely we all long for a place in our lives where we are accepted and embraced and cared about, a place where we go because it feels good to be there. Ministers want that too, but by necessity we have a different kind of relationship with the congregations we serve. As the leadership guru Ron Heifetz clearly states, our job is to stand in a different place in congregations, and the term that he uses is standing on the balcony, where we are always trying to see the big picture. And so as I approach retirement, I am looking forward to going back to my home church, stepping off the balcony, and once again being a parishioner and having what you have in abundance, having community. But as Leo Rosten says, religious community is more than a place of comfort and friendship. At its heart, it's a place of transformation, which means it's also a place of discomfort sometimes, because it is always calling us to be more than we are, more than we're comfortable being or doing or giving, and we need that discomfort too. As Kevin reads this excerpt from Roger Housden's Seven Sins for a Life Worth Living, hear the experience of universal oneness that he describes.
Housden tells the story of a young boy living in a small village called St. Catherine's Valley in England. One day, this boy decided to branch out in his explorations of the area and rode his bike 20 miles east of the valley to the stone circle of Avebury. The boy, now grown, writes, "There, for the first time, I knew beyond doubt that life was not merely what everyone seemed to take for granted, because here was this staggering testament to another world, a circle of stones big enough to contain a village. Great fingers point to the sky for almost 5,000 years. The whole area is alive with the presence of a mysterious culture that we know almost nothing about. On the edge of Avebury itself was Silbury Hill, one of the greatest unsolved archaeological mysteries in Europe. A huge earth pyramid that must have taken thousands of people years to erect, and still no one knows for what purpose. That day, on my first visit to Avebury, I sat on top of Silbury Hill, a crescent moon rising, the chalk land fading into mist along the edge of the horizon, and I felt my place in the circle of the human family. I felt the living presence of all those who had been in that land before me and those who were still to come, and I knew that through time and also through space, we were of one kind.
It is, I believe, one of our faith's great goals to help break down barriers so that we move beyond the comfort of the familiar, stretching towards finding a place not just in the vast and little-known circle of the human family, but also in the interdependent web of all existence. You may be interested to know that at Wednesday night's Music and Worship Committee meeting, in addition to planning the end-of-the-year services, a good part of the discussion that night focused on birds, hawks and crows and talking parrots. It was wonderful. And out of that came a decision to have a service on animal intelligence next year, although I did note the preaching spot for that morning still remains open. But to care about and learn about and offer support and solidarity with people who are not like us, and I think of the candle that we heard this morning about those young girls in Pakistan, and also species different from our own, is the spiritual heart-opening work of church. My friend and colleague, the Reverend Janet Bush, says that we UUs are shy about prayer and that our hymns are really a way of praying. And in fact, I think it is a way we give thanks. And perhaps giving thanks is truly the sine qua non of church, gratitude for blessings, for beauty, for existence, gratitude for simply being. Where else do we go where we bow our heads and lift our voices in song and say, thank you? And now to close with a poem of thanks by poet laureate Billy Collins.
As if to demonstrate an eclipse, I pick an orange from a wicker basket and place it on the table to represent the sun. Then down at the other end, a blue and white marble becomes the earth, and nearby I lay the little moon of an aspirin. I get a glass from a cabinet, open a bottle of wine, then I sit in a ladder-backed chair, a benevolent god presiding over a miniature creation myth. And I begin to sing a homemade canticle of thanks for this perfect little arrangement, for not making the earth too hot or cold, for not making it spin too fast or slow, so that the grove of orange trees and the owl become possible, not to mention the rolling wave, the play of clouds, geese in flight, and the Z of lightning on a dark lake. Then I fill my glass again and give thanks for the trout, the oak, and the yellow feather, singing the room full of shadows as sun and earth and moon circle one another in their impeccable orbits, and I get more and more cockeyed with gratitude.